We're going to be in Proverbs chapter 31 this morning. Proverbs chapter 31, as we continue on looking at the wife in the family, we have seen her submission, we have seen her respect, and this morning I want us to consider the work of a wife, and I want to consider this particular woman that's given to us as a kind of paradigm in the scripture when we think of what a woman should be like. We usually think of Proverbs 31. Many have done their cross stitch or other things in which that chapter, portion of chapter, is hanging on a wall somewhere, because it is a beautiful chapter, and it is as well, remember in this chapter, the words of King Lemuel, the prophecy that his mother taught him. Who can find a virtuous woman? Her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, that he shall have no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. As we come to this chapter and we think about the virtuous woman, her work, domesticity, domestic policy. When we talk about our domestic policy in the country, what are we talking about? We're talking about the policy here at home. Here is the policy here at home. The women reformers, and as I get into this library of children's books, I find that the majority of the books written about women, or little portions about women, not all of them, but oftentimes it has to be the women's rights reformers that they wrote about for little girls to read about. It's not always the case, but it often is. Women reformers have fought very hard for a long time in this country for, well, probably almost 200 years now, actually, since 1800. There have been those who have fought hard to get women, as they say, out of the home and into the real world, into the workforce. They had a number of goals, as I think about and summarize just voluminous readings of their writings. Their goal was to educate women, but not just educate them toward a career. That's the goal. The believers have always believed in educating their young ladies. And their young ladies have been the most educated of all the religious groups of the world. But their goal is to educate them toward a career. And what they mean by that is to get independence. Independence from a husband. Independence from an order of society which God has set forth. They want to equalize the marriage partnership to where the wife does not have to follow a husband or consider herself supporting his calling. But they want her to have her own calling. They want her to have a separate calling. They want her to be on her own, independent of him. And their goal has also been to reduce the number of children that are in the home. That has always been the stated goal. They don't hide that. They want to reduce the number of children in the home, put the children in public institutions as soon as possible, put the elderly in public institutions also, because it's children and elderly that hold them down to the home or the domestic scene. And so that has been their goal, to bring ladies into the workforce as if they did not work before that. The ladies have always worked, and here in Proverbs 31, it gives us the scene of their work. This policy at home. The goal of feminists have been independence from men first. And that is the stated goal. From the tyranny of men, from the tyranny of authority, from the tyranny of order. And the second goal has been independence from the duties of family. To get away from the nurturing of children. To get away from wiping snotty noses. We're not going to be slaves in the home anymore to our kids or to the old folks. We want to be independent of that. Now, I don't think I'm exaggerating the situation. I think if you read the material yourself, you will see that these are the stated goals that they have. We can't be fulfilled at home. We need to do what men do. We need to be like men. I was reading in the Oneida community, that cult that was up in New York, how they urged their women to be more manly. What they actually meant by that, just that they would work harder. Titus chapter 2, let's turn there, let's just read that, and then we'll come back to Proverbs. Titus chapter 2, as he lays out the different duties of the respective people within the assembly. Verse 3, the aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becomes holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women to be sober, and to love their husbands, and to love their children, to be discreet, to be chaste, to be keepers at home, to be good, to be obedient to their own husbands, so that the word of God be not blasphemed. And of course, a hue and cry goes out from that chapter, whenever you read that, and those who have a feministic tendency. Nancy Wilson, in her book, Praise Her in the Gates, she has a section here I wanted to share with you on the domestic arts. She writes, domesticity is a devotion to home and family life. How few in our day understand it, but Christian women can embrace the call to domesticity. It's our territory. In a sense, we Christians own it. The unbelieving woman cannot experience the fullness of joy there is in being domestic to the glory of God. The unbeliever can struggle to do domestic things, but she cannot be domestic under the blessings of God. God created marriage. He creates homes. He delegates the management of the home to the wife, and He gives us the desire and the ability to imitate Him in creating lovely surroundings for our families in our homes. But the domestic arts are quickly becoming obsolete. How many women know how to cook anything besides a microwave meal? Women are too busy at the office to bake bread or care about preparing meals. There really is no such thing as a supermom. She has to make a choice. Will she manage the home or work at a full-time job outside the home? It is impossible to do both long-term. And domesticity is a long-term commitment with long-term benefits and long-term blessings. The Virtuous Woman, Proverbs 31. There's a lot of folks that claim this particular chapter. Just about everybody claims this chapter, as far as ladies from every different perspective of life. The evangelical feminists claim this chapter. As they say, within this chapter, we find the career woman, because you find her to be a real estate agent, because she goes out, she buys a field. She's a real estate agent. I'll tell you this. Anybody that's been in real estate here, if the only thing you ever did was buy one piece of real estate and you bought it for yourself, you'd be out of business pretty quick. And they say, well, she sold things to merchants. That's right, she did. She sold things to merchants. We're going to look at that. Because not only is she not a career woman, and she is not what the feminists believe, but she is also not what I call barefoot and pregnant. And what I mean by that is this. I mean, she is not some dumb little gal who's never been taught anything. The only thing she can do is produce babies, and she can never step outside of the four walls of her house. That's not the picture given here either. When he says a virtuous woman, the Hebrew word is very interesting, because this may be the only place where it's translated virtuous. Most of the time it has to do with an army. She is an army of one. She is a woman of valor. I would rather place in there valor or strength, because when we think of virtue, generally we only think of moral strength. That is in there. But there's more than just moral strength here. There is physical strength, there is emotional strength, there is intellectual strength. When we think of the virtue, we say the virtue has gone out in something. What are we saying? The strength is gone. Lost the strength. So what we're talking about is a woman of strength, a woman of valor, a virtuous woman. And it's evident by the context as well that this strength is dominant within the text, because over and over again it talks about her strength. Verse 10, who can find a virtuous woman? Who can find? So in Solomon's day, in the day of King Lemuel, is not so totally different from our day. This woman was rare in his day as well. There were all sorts and types from the beginning of the world of women, some evil, some good, some virtuous, some not so virtuous, and some who excelled them all, as this particular woman that he speaks of. Who can find a virtuous woman, a woman of valor, a woman of strength? Well, if you can find her, you can't afford her to pay her by the hourly wage. You'd never be able to afford it, because her value is above rubies. Her value is above rubies. You look at this woman and what she does, and you try to put an hourly value on that, you wouldn't be able to give that woman a salary because of what she does and keeps together in body and soul around her home. It is priceless. It is priceless. It is priceless, number one, because her labor flows out of this virtue, flows out of this strength, this moral strength, intellectual strength, emotional strength, physical strength. That's what her labor flows out of. It's not just ability, it's not just intellect, but it has that moral aspect to it as well, which is obvious within the text. Good work comes from a good heart. Valuable work comes from a good heart. What is priceless? Look at verse 11. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. That's priceless. Trust is priceless. That's something that has to be earned. That is not something that you can just come up with in a day. He has no worries, no concerns about the matters at the house. He can go forward with the dominion work that he has to do himself, because he knows that he's got somebody at home that's taking care of the business of the home, that's managing the home, which the scriptures do in 1 Timothy as well. He talks about the young widows. I will that they bear children and manage the house. The managing of the house is given into the hands of the lady through the authority of her husband. She understands what he wants, and she seeks what he wants. And so the heart of her husband safely trusts in her. And what else is priceless? What else is priceless is that he has no need of spoil. He has no need of any other treasures. She is his treasure. She is his treasure. And she will see to it that the household is managed properly. He will not have to gamble. He will not have to steal, because he has a wife at home whose money, the money just disappears. And no matter how much money you give her, it's gone. There are such ladies. I've known such ladies. I've dealt with their families. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in him. He will have no need of spoil. And he won't have to be looking for another lady either, because she is the one he wants. She is the one he loves. He will have no need of spoil. In verse 12, she will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. Her work is never at cross purposes with his. Submission. She knows her husband's vision of dominion work. She knows what would hinder that work. And so she doesn't do the things that would hinder that dominion work that her husband has. She knows, as a helpmeet, she seeks to do him good. She knows which things will be of a help to that dominion work. And so she seeks to do those things. In the way she manages the house, in the way she talks about her husband to other people, she seeks to do him good. in the way she presents herself to others, knowing that her presentation to others will have a bearing upon his dominion work as well. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. He has no need of spoil. How does she work? She works willingly. She works willingly. She works gladly. Notice in verse 13, she seeks wool and flax and she works willingly with her hands, it says. She works willingly with her hands. She understands that work, hard work, is a part of God's world, a part of God's purposes. It's not just the men who have the sweat of the brow. That's generic. The sweat of the brow is generic. It's men and women. She works willingly with her hands. She takes up the work. She understands that in a sin-cursed world, that the work is not going to be an easy work. From the very fact that she brings forth the children into her home and deals with the children all day long, if you want to know what the curse is about, if you want to know what bearing children in sorrow is about, it's rearing those children. Those little sin-cursed children whose ways are evil and you don't have to teach them evil. She works willingly with her hands. She understands the appointment of God for her, her place in the home, and she takes on the work willingly. And she serves God with her hands. What can I do for God? Well, the scripture says she seeks wool and flax and works willingly with her hands. She serves God by her sewing. She serves God by her providing clothes for her family. She serves God by cleaning. She serves God by teaching her children. She serves God by laundry and dishes. She serves God by soothing and nurturing her children. She serves God by decorating and arranging flowers. She works willingly with her hands. She does whatever is necessary to manage the home. She is a manager. And a manager has a lot to do because they have oversight of a whole lot of things. While her husband is doing the dominion work that has been appointed to him, she is managing a little world at home. Her hands work willingly, gladly. And this particular woman that we're talking about is a woman of prominence. This is not an obscure woman. This is a woman whose husband is sitting in the gates, who is a prominent man in society. So that tells us something about work. That work is not a four-letter word. It's not a dirty word. She works willingly with her hands. Her husband's in the gates. I dare say that if she wanted to, she could just defer all this work to everybody else. But she's wiser than that. Because a virtuous woman, a strong woman, will work willingly. She's carding the wool, she's spinning the thread, she's side by side with her maidens who are doing the same work, she's training them, she's showing them what to do, she's showing her children what to do, she's setting an example for everyone around her in the way that she works hard, and in the way that she works, in her understanding in her work. She does what is necessary. There are no menial jobs. There never have been. There's only unfinished jobs. She works willingly. Her willing work flows from her purpose. She has purposeful work. She knows why she is working. She understands why she is working. She knows to what end she is working. She has a purpose in life. She has a vision in life. And part of the problem in this country was that through all of the propaganda against the home, against children, against marriage, what we ended up with at times were women who were in the home, but they weren't sure why they were there. And the children were gone to a public institution, and they had all the labor-saving devices in the home, and sometimes she just sat around and watched soaps, and that was a waste of her life. She didn't know why she was there. She had lost purpose for being there. This woman works purposefully. She knows to what end she is working. It is the will of God that she work, first of all. She recognizes a work ethic. We have to recognize that. Number two, she works to help her husband. She recognizes that she's created a helpmate. Number three, she works to manage her household. She knows that she was created not only to be a helpmate to her husband, to manage the household, whatever that involved. For this particular woman, it involved quite a bit. Not all of us are going to have all of these things, of servants as well as children and everything else. But whatever a household entails. And number four, she works to affect the wider community as well, which we see within this text also. In good works, in charitable works that went outside of the home. First of all, to help her husband. Verse 11 and 12, we've already seen that. A great help to her husband. The greatest help that a woman can be to her husband, one of the greatest things is to be trustworthy. To be trustworthy. To be worthy of his trust. To free him of that concern. What drags a man more than anything else? If he is afraid of what's going on at home, if he is afraid of what his wife is doing, that's a burden. That is a drag upon him and his work. But here we see he is freed up to concern himself with the business that God has given to him because she takes care of the business that was entrusted to her, to help her husband. He rejoices in her moral strength. He rejoices in the respect that she shows to him. He won't have to go anywhere else to look for it because he gets it at home. He rejoices in the affection that she has for him. He won't need the affection of anyone else. In verse 12, another great help is she seeks his welfare. She does him good and not evil. That's why he can attend to business. And in verse 23, we notice it says that he is an elder. He sits among the elders in the gates. She helps him to be all the influence that he can be in the world. Because she recognizes that her home is the domestic scene. His home is to go out for the glory of God and to exercise dominion in this world. And a man's duty is to go out into the world and exercise dominion for Jesus Christ. And because she is taking care of those things, the implication of the text is because she is doing these things, he can do this. And he can have this wider sphere of influence himself as well, not just with his home. There's some these days, with the call back to the home, they think that a husband is supposed to be back in the home. We've got to be careful of that. Yes, the husband has his time in the home, but his duty is to go into the world and to exercise dominion for Jesus Christ as well. Husbands have to be away sometimes. Part of the problem of our country is that we have given the political realm to the pagans. And Christian men have not exerted their influence there. It doesn't do us any good to be sitting at home watching TV if the country is going to go to hell. So this particular man is seen as someone who sits in the gates, someone who has an influence within the community. And we know the reason why he can do it. It's because of the wife that he has behind him. She has freed him up to do these things and to have this influence. And she recognizes, she's not saying, oh, do you have to go to that city hall meeting again tonight? Oh, can't you just stay home? She doesn't say that. She understands that this is his work. This is his calling from God to exercise a godly influence in the wider community. There's sacrifice involved. That's what I'm saying. There's always sacrifice involved. But it's sacrifice to do the will of God. In verse 28, her husband hallels her. He praises her. He praises her. He appreciates what she does. He appreciates all the hard work. He appreciates the managing of the home. He appreciates the fact of what she does for him. And it's our duty to encourage our wives and appreciate the work that they do and the labor that they do. Secondly, she not only understands that it's her duty to help her husband to manage her household. She looks to the domestic duties. She is fulfilled in her duties toward her home. All she does is aimed at blessing the household. blessing her husband, blessing the children, blessing the servants. Much sacrifice, but much blessing too, and much fulfillment in what she does. See how often the word household is used within this text. Look at verse 15. She rises also while it is night and gives meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. Look at verse 21. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. Look at verse 27 and 26. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. She looks well to the ways of her household, and she does not eat the bread of idleness. And the response of her household is that her children call her blessed and her husband praises her. So she works purposefully to care for this household. This household that she has is not only within the realm of her household. In verse 21, it deals with some of the things she does for her household. But her realm is also going to take her actually outside of these things as well. When she is caring for this household, what we find is that her work is purposefully toward, and that's why I laugh about them talking about her buying the field in verse 16. She considers the field and buys it, and with the fruit of her hand she plants the vineyard. Why does she do these things? In her mind, all of this is directed toward the household. When she is working with the wool and flax and bringing it into cloth and then into clothing, her idea is toward her household. When she is, in verse 26, opening her mouth with wisdom and kindness and looking well to what? The ways of her household. Everything she's doing, she's looking to the ways of her household and looking not only to their physical needs, which we've already seen, in the clothing and feeding of them, but also she looks to the ways of her household spiritually. And that's what verse 27 is about. She looks well to the ways of her household. Because the verse just before talked about the law of kindness and charity in her tongue. So what she's doing is she's considering the needs of her household, considering where each one fits in God's plan, considering what do they need. How does this child need to be guided in this way? How does this servant need to be guided in this way? How can I care for my husband in this particular way? She looks well to the ways of her household. So she works for her household, she works for her husband, and she works in a larger sphere also outside of her household, because it says that she, in verse 20, stretches out her hand to the poor, and she reaches forth her hands to the needy. So she doesn't stay within the four walls. She reaches out to the community as well. With all the things that she can do to care for the poor and the needy, this has typically been what Christians have done throughout the centuries. They have typically looked for those who are down and out that they could help. And sometimes the down and out are because of our downer and outers because of sin in their lives. Which means we don't have the attitude, well, the reason they're messed up is just because they're a bunch of wretched sinners. We've got to be careful of that attitude. And what we've got to be able to see is that God calls us to reach out into the community, even to those who are downers and outers because of their wickedness and sin. And to seek if we can have a Christian influence upon those. And a wife is made for these kinds of things. Her compassion is broad, and it goes not only to her husband and her children, those within her household, but her compassion is so great, a woman's compassion is so great, that it reaches forth, and it'll go forth into the community. It'll reach out to other families as well, and a husband should encourage that. At times, a husband may not want to encourage that because he doesn't want her taken away from the duties of the household. But he has to recognize, too, that there is a calling beyond, that she has an influence beyond with others as well that can be very useful. Not that she's away from it, neglecting her duties, but there is that calling. So she works willingly with her hands, and she works purposefully. She knows what her purpose is. Toward her husband, toward the household, and toward the broader community as well, for the glory of Christ. And she works hard, and she works long. It does not mean she spends no time in reflection. She obviously does, because the strength that she has comes out of her reflection of God, her meditation upon the divine. And that's why she's called blessed, and that's why she's praised. But she works hard and long. Nancy Wilson in one of her books said that one of the things we think sometimes is if we're exhausted and if we're tired, we must be doing something wrong. Actually, if we're exhausted and we're tired, we're probably doing something right. Because the work is hard work. And the labor of the sleep of a laboring man is the sleep of a laboring woman is sweet. That's generic too. It is hard work. Even with what we have, there's always a lot to do. Look at verse 13. In verse 13, she describes seeking the wool and the flax. And so, this particular woman in this situation that he's describing as a woman of strength and a woman of valor, she doesn't just buy the cloth. It's possible that she could just go and buy the cloth. But she is seeking the wool and the flax, which means she's seeking the raw materials, which means she's going to have to prepare them to make the thread, and then she's going to have to make the thread. And after she makes the thread, then she's going to have to weave it into the cloth. And after she makes the cloth, then she's going to have to make it into the clothing. And so there's that whole tedious, hard labor and process that she goes through. A virtuous woman works hard and she works long. Indeed, she may even be a part of growing the flax and wool and harvesting, even as the virtuous women of the colonies did in the early days. It was hard work. Look at verse 14. Verse 14 says she's like the merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. Food has to be grown. It has to be harvested from the fields. It has to be preserved. They had to go through all different things, whether you were drying it, or what process you were using, it was work, it was hard labor. Or they purchased certain things from the market on a daily basis, go there every day, take care of those things that you needed to get from day to day. There's the preparation of meals continually. So we look in verse 15, she rises while it is yet night, and she gives meat to her household. And so this is no small part of a woman's work in ministry, is the cooking, the nutrition, the meal times. It's what makes home a home. The gathering around the food. The gathering around dinner. Not going to our separate rooms because we all have a television set in our rooms or a PC and we all want to watch something different. We all take our food and go somewhere else. We need to get back to the understanding of Christian community within our own homes, to where we actually gather around food again. And we share the joy of family around that food. Verse 15, I want us to note this. Amidst her labors, it says she rises while it is yet night to give meat to her household and a portion, it says. And the portion here, I don't think is talking about the food to her maidens, but the Hebrew word for portion here is a task, an appointed work. There's a delegation going on. What she's doing is she's, yes, providing food for everyone, and then she's giving them their appointed task for the day. And she's laying out the appointed tasks. Here's what you have to do. Here's what you need to do. Here's what I expect from you here. This is very important in the life of a virtuous woman or a woman of valor. Because the woman of valor doesn't do everything herself. Sometimes we feel like we're people of valor if we're just going to do it all by ourselves. I'm not going to make the kids do anything. I'm going to do it by myself. It's just easier by myself, which it is easier a lot of times. But they need to be taught. And they need responsibility. And they need it delegated to them. And there needs to be expectations for them. And she has servants as well. And she has expectations for them too. She works hard and long, and she delegates these things out as well to others. Verse 16, the planting of the vineyard. She buys the field, and then she plants the vineyard, the preparing of the soil, the planting of the seed, the nourishing of it, the weeding, the pruning, the maintaining. Nothing but work. Gardens are nothing but work. Hard work. But the whole idea that we're being given in this passage is the tremendous hard work that a virtuous woman does. She is a woman of strength. It is true that men are stronger than women, but women have an endurance about them in their work and labor. They may not be able to pick up as much as you can, but they can endure and work hour after hour, and not only work with all these tedious small things, but all the tedious problems of children as well, which would wear us men out to a frazzle. The crying children, give it to mom. You know, things that would just put us in the bed. We'd be so tired and worn out emotionally from listening to those kids sometimes. A woman is very strong in the sense that she is able to bear up under these things as well as the thousand other duties she has to do. So there's strength there. There's hard work there. In verse 17, she sets herself for the work. She girds her loins with strength and she strengtheneth her arms. So there is physical strength, intellectual, moral, emotional strength that this particular text describes in a woman. In verses 18 and 19, the candle gets burned at both ends at times until nature just puts you in bed at times. She perceives that her merchandise is good, her candle goeth out, not by night. She lays her hands to the spindle and her hands hold the distaff. It's hard work. It's hard work. And this strength and this compassion and this work, as I said, doesn't just go to her household. Then, beyond all of that, in verse 20, she also stretches out her hand to the poor and the needy. That takes strength. It's hard work. It's labor. It's labor to help others. It's labor to look at the poor and the needy and to go to them and bring them a meal or do this for them or something else for them. It's just more work to be done. And yet that is the description of this virtuous woman. She works purposefully to help her husband, to manage and nurture the household, to reach out to the community. She works hard. She works long. But it also describes her as working skillfully. Look at verse 21. It says she is not afraid of the snow for her household. It says that all of her household are clothed in scarlet. She works hard and she works skillfully. Verse 22 speaks of tapestry, silk, and purple. Verses 23 and 24 speaks of fine linen and girdles. It talks about those domestic arts that women learned and passed down from generation to generation. And this particular woman who is caring for her family, the scarlet there, there's a lot of debate on that particular Hebrew word. The word for scarlet is double dyed. And that's because of the process that it took to bring about this particular color. Here, it seems to indicate a double garment. That's why she's not afraid of the snow for her family, because they have double garments on. Coverdale, in his translation, called it their double clothed, doubled the coats. But it talks about this tapestry. It talks about silk and it talks about purple. She's using some of the finest cloths and she has ability. And she's obviously providing things with this fine linen and girdles that she's bringing to the merchant. She's providing for some of the folks who are rich and who are able to pay for this kind of thing. And by this, she is helping provide for her home as well. The tapestry, floor coverings, rugs, bed coverings, all these things are included in the description of this woman, this virtuous woman. She works skillfully. And there is a loss of these kinds of skills in our society. There is a loss of just basic skills sometimes among women. Young girls can grow up in homes and never learn how to cook. Young girls can grow up in homes and never learn how to sew. And that ought not to be so. These skills are important skills and they're useful skills. And they're things that ought to be passed on from generation to generation. Nancy Wilson, in her book, complains about the loss of skills like lace making and other hand embroidery work. Beautiful things that ladies have always done. but that it's getting down to so few know how to do these things. This virtuous woman that's described in this passage is a woman who works with skill. She has skill. So she works willingly, she works purposefully, hard and long, skillfully, but she works wisely. She works wisely as well. She considers a field. She sees a field. She finds out that it's available. She considers, how can my household be furthered? How can we stretch our resources a little bit further? Well, we could plant our own vineyard. Then we wouldn't have to buy the wine. We could have it ourselves. And so you see her, this description and the application for Our Lady's is that it is this whole consideration of the household. It's not just a static situation where we're never thinking of new things that can be done, where we're not thinking ahead, where we're not thinking about greater economy, where we're not thinking about how my household can be blessed in new ways. This woman is thinking of everything she can do. In verse 18, she knows which work of hers is valuable, which one makes the profit. She works at that. There's no false modesty here. Her merchandise is good, and she knows it. What she does is good. She knows it, and she can sell it, and she does. But the greatest wisdom is not needed for lands and merchandise. The greatest wisdom that a lady needs is to deal with the souls that are inside her care in that household. And that's why verses 26 and 27 are so important. It says, she opens her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the Torah of charity, kindness, the law of kindness, a law of compassion. She looks well to the ways of her household. When her mouth opens up, there is wisdom, there is common sense there. She's not the Hollywood woman, the flighty woman that they try to set forth, some flighty lady. She is a woman of good sense. And the reason she's a woman of good sense is because she's a woman of this book, first of all. This book will give you plenty of good sense. She is a woman who opens her mouth with wisdom. And in her tongue, there is a law of kindness. And if you are going to manage people, you're going to have both of those things, wisdom and kindness. Who here has not been underneath someone at some time who was not wise or who was not kind? A lady has to have wisdom to direct, to instruct, to give knowledge and wisdom for all of the duties of the household. How much more do we need? How much more wisdom do we need than in our instructing of our children, in the rearing of our children, in 1,000 situations that happen during the day? And how much more kindness do we need than in dealing with those children? How frustrating those children can be. How you want to lash out at those children. How you want to tell them, that's stupid. You're just stupid. And that happens. But this woman, there's a law of kindness. It's a law. Because she knows that that's not the way to get results. You don't get results by berating people. Nobody ever has, and nobody ever will. It won't happen in the workplace. It won't happen in the home either. You get stuff out of people by treating them with regard and respect and with dignity. By reproving with kindness. By instructing with patience. By using this common sense. We don't want just heads packed with trivia. We have to use that knowledge, how to live wisely. The souls will shrivel up under us if we're harsh. Edith Schaefer, in her book On the Home, used an illustration which always sticks in my mind of a little girl who's out in the fields. It's been raining. She goes out and her mother's at the house. Her mother's cleaning up, getting the house all clean, got the kitchen all cleaned. The child is out. She finds some flowers. She thinks about her mother. And so she picks the flowers to take back to her mother. But it's been wet out there, and her feet are muddy. She comes back in the house, and she tromps into the kitchen. It's got mud all over the kitchen now. And her mother says, "What are you doing? How many times have I told you, get out of here with that mud?" and the flowers drop to her side, and she goes out. The child's whole mind was consumed with the love that she had for her mother. But the mother forgot at that instance and only saw the mud and didn't see the child's intent. That's what this scripture is talking about. When I read it, and it says she looks well to the ways of her household. She studies her family. She studies the situations. And she makes sure that her tongue is always a law of kindness on it and compassion. Because those kinds of things, those little things like that, have a great effect upon lives. Adam Clark, the old Methodist, writes about this moral management. She is wise. She is intelligent. She has not neglected the cultivation of her mind. She is amiable in her carriage. She is full of good nature, well-tempered, conciliating in her manners and address. There are very few of those called managing women who are not lords over their husbands, tyrants over their servants, and insolent among their neighbors. But she is a meek and quiet spirit. She is a blessed woman. He finishes out this section after he deals with all the different ways that she works. And he talks about, and notice in verse 29, many daughters have done virtuously or valiantly. Many daughters have been strong, but you excel them all. Favor, he says, is deceitful. Favor or grace of manner. Grace of manner can be deceitful. You can put on a good appearance. You can be well-bred. But you can be well-bred and be dead. Dead inside. Favor can be deceitful. Beauty, he says, is vain. It is often empty. It is often just a shell. Those who spend inordinate amounts of time on the beauty and fretting it and going to plastic surgeons and this, that, and something else, they are some of the most unlovely people inside. Because everything has been, all the work and labor and time and thought has been upon the outward. And they have not given enough to the soul. Beauty is vain. It's often empty. Favor can be deceitful, but the fear of God, he says, this is what produces a woman of valor, a woman of strength, a fear of God, a regard for God. Once again, how does this moral and intellectual and physical and emotional, where does this all flow from? This all flows out of this relationship to God, out of this fear of God, out of this regard for God. This woman is no fool. This woman can hold her own in society. And when she's out and about taking care of things, she can hold her own out there. Why? Because she has a regard for God. She has a strong spirit. Because she reverences God and she fears God. We have known of many martyred ladies who went to the stake as well, and ladies who were drowned. They were women of courage. They were women of spirit. They were virtuous women, women of strength. And it all flowed out of this fear of God that they had. Moral strength of character, physical strength to endure, intellectual strength to guide, emotional strength to nurture, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands. Let her reap what she has sown. She will. She will reap what she sows. And in the gates, she will not be obscure. She will be known beyond her house. She will not be obscure. Give her the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gates. Remember Dorcas, who cared so much and made all those coats for those widow ladies. She was known outside her home. And there's another lady that I wanted to share with you as an illustration. This lady was Martha Dandridge Washington. Her husband, George, called her Patsy. The Revolutionary War was coming on. He writes concerning Martha Washington and her part of the war. In those days of narrow dirt roads, it was impossible to carry on a military campaign in winter. Opposing armies always used to go into winter quarters and stay there until the frost was out and the mud was dried. So they take a little break from the war. Can't do that anymore. But in those days, you could. November 1775 arrived, and Martha started north to be with her husband at winter quarters. That first year, the army was at Cambridge, Massachusetts. She took her own coach with her son Jack as an escort and drove all the way from Mount Vernon. The roads were bad and the weather was cold. It was late in December before her mud-spattered coach rolled up before the door of Washington's headquarters in Cambridge. And with the return of spring, she made the long, hard journey by coach back to Mount Vernon. And this she did every year, no matter where the winter quarters were, in order to do what she could to make her husband comfortable. Two of those winters were spent in Morristown, New Jersey. Already she was being called Lady Washington. But wealthy aristocrat though she was, she lived and dressed so simply that once an innkeeper at Morristown mistook her for a housemaid. Ladies of the town who came to pay their respects one day were surprised to discover the wife of the commander-in-chief with an apron on, darning socks. It was that terrible winter which came between the two seasons at Morristown, which showed the pure gold quality of Martha Washington. That was the time that tried men's souls, the winter at Valley Forge. Then it seemed as if all were lost, the men in rags, food scarce, sickness in every cabin, deserters quitting every day, no money to pay the soldiers. When Martha started for Valley Forge, she suspected the food was scarce. And though she could not feed an army, she stuffed the coach inside and out with all the food she could carry. And when she arrived, she discovered her general quartered in a very small apartment. But, she added cheerfully in a letter to a friend, he has a log cabin to dine in. And all that fearful winter, she went round the camp, visiting the sick, darning the socks, mending the clothes, doing anything and everything that a big-hearted woman could think of to relieve the suffering there. It's a virtuous woman. She's a woman of strength. She's a woman of strength. Lady Washington, who gladly shared the hardships of Army winter quarters year after year during the struggle of the American Revolution. This was in order, he says, to be at the side of her great husband and to help him with everything in her power. So completely did she identify herself with him that some standard works of reference do not give her a place distinct from George Washington, but that's the way Martha would have wanted it. Who can find a virtuous woman? She works willingly with her hands. She works purposefully. She knows why she's working. To aid her husband, to care for a household, to extend out into the greater community. She works hard and she works long. She works wisely. She works skillfully. The picture he gives to us is a very beautiful picture. It's a picture of the Hebrew women. The Hebrew women didn't have veils and cower in their tents all day long. The Hebrew women were out working in the fields, in the marketplace, and yet it was all around the household. It was all around the home. And I think this is a wonderful picture for us to renew again in our own hearts and minds when we think about the work of a woman. Because for too long, from both our pulpits and in our universities and everywhere else, this picture has been mocked and scorned. The picture of domesticity, the picture of caring about somebody's home, the picture about nurturing your own children, as if it didn't matter whether or not you nurture your children, as if it didn't matter whether or not you helped your husband. That's a completely wrong idea. It's not a Christian idea. And we must have firmly fixed in our minds in order to escape the molding of this world what the idea is given in Scripture of this ideal woman in the way that she works, in the way that she works. May God give grace to us to lay hold upon these things and lay hold upon the strength that this woman has And that strength is found in the fear of God. It's found in a reverence for God. Favor is deceitful. Beauty is empty. But a woman who fears God, she'll be praised. She'll be praised.